We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. Also happy to have back here again on the program, Scott Spies. He's a home inspector with the Spies Home Inspection Service, and this is a program we've been doing now for a long time, once a month, always on the Monday, to open up the phone lines here and give folks the chance to call in and ask questions about home maintenance. So, if you have some kind of a problem and you're not quite sure how to approach it, or maybe something needs to be repaired, or you're thinking of making some changes, doing some remodeling, whatever, whatever's on your mind, I know that Scott knows a lot about the single family home and its various pieces and parts. So, if you have questions about insulation, heating and cooling, gutters, attics, basements, whatever, give us a call, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. And we also have toll-free line that's good anywhere you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you have questions, you give us a call. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Good morning, David. Thank you for having me.
We have somebody ready to go already. We will go right to them. And this is someone who's calling from Lafayette on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello. Pretty straightforward question. Do my smoke detectors and my monoxide detector, over the years, do they tend to wear out and need to be replaced?
Most of the time, smoke detectors have a fail-safe on them, or if they start to have a problem, they will start to beep. They are something that you want to test about every couple of months. I believe the fire department says to check them when you change your clocks just to make sure that they are operational. So, yes, they are something that can wear out and should be tested at least once or twice a year.
Yeah, I didn't mean just run down, but the sensor wear out and you have to buy a new one.
Basically, if the test button is working, then the general idea is that the sensor is working as well. Now, if you happen to have them in a very dusty, dirty climate, such as a basement shop or something like that, where you're getting a lot of dust and dirt in, yes, that could actually cloud the sensor for the smoke alarm. For the carbon monoxide detector, I don't think that's an issue. The carbon monoxide detector doesn't use the same type of sensor as what the smoke detector does.
Okay, mine plugs in the wall. I'll ask you, what about a hygrometer for measuring humidity in the house?
I recommend them on a regular basis, actually. It's a good way of monitoring just how much humidity or how much moisture level that you have in the house. That's something that David and I were just talking about before the show. Particularly in times like this where we have rainy, damp weather and it's going to get cold on us here pretty quick. And the next thing you know, your humidity level in the house is going to come up. So having some idea of how much humidity is in the house isn't a bad idea, particularly if you've got a relatively tight house and we need to worry about mold and mildew issues. We don't want to see that the moisture level really climb unreasonable.
Will a hygrometer wear out?
Actually, it doesn't wear out, but it does get some dust and dirt on the sensor because in order for it to measure the moisture level in the house, it does have to be open out to the air, and a little bit of dust and dirt on the two little plastic strips will cause it to have a poor reading. It'll still give you a good idea of things going up and down, but yes, it will lose accuracy with time.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
All right. Very good. Let's continue. The next is someone in Champaign. This is line 1. Hello.
Hi. I have two questions, both about water. Mm-hmm. One has to do with our roof. We have a sunroom. We have an older home, 1920s, with a flat-top sunroof that has a rubber kind of roof. And it's more than 20 years old, I think. And it's got kind of alligator cracking kind of in the in the material itself. We've had a roofer come in. They sealed the seams, but I'm sitting here looking at the rain pouring into buckets right now through the roof. So I'm wondering, what is the lifespan on those kind of roofs? Do you have to replace it when it starts doing that, or can you, can you repair?
Okay, well, it depends on whether or not you have a rubber roof or where you have a modified bituminous roofing. Generally speaking, the rubber roofing does not give you the alligator cracks. Usually the modified bit or the torch-applied single-ply roofing materials, which have a tar coating, they will tend to show a little bit of the alligator or the cracking and checking that you're describing. And usually there is a coating you can put on it to help extend its life. However, once you start getting leaks, and as you self-described there, a few buckets, it's probably due for replacement.
Okay, so you would just replace.
It would. My guess is once it started leaking, we get water underneath the membrane, that it's probably worn enough that it is time to replace it.
Okay. Well, that's a good good suggestion. My other question about water has to do with our window wells. Again, an older house, very huge window wells, not custom. They'd be custom sized. We've talked for years about getting window well covers for them, and I can't find that they manufacture them. There's height to the window. It's not just level with the ground, and it's also very wide and very deep. Do you have any suggestions about, how to make them, out of what materials, or and what kind of design?
Well, I mean, there's any number of different things you can put over the top of them, from wrought iron steel grates if you're trying to actually put a cover, something to keep out everything, usually a Lexan with a wood frame. Most carpenters are fairly capable of being able to design something where they can put a ledger on the siding that they can hook the cover up to. Really, it doesn't necessarily need to have a cover. You're not going to get enough rainfall into the window well to actually create a problem. If you have window wells that fill up with water, it usually means that the groundwater is draining towards it, not necessarily just what is falling from the sky. We just don't get that much rain coming down. Now, if you've got a gutter over the top of it that's dripping into it, that's a different story.
Well, we have a neighbor whose property is higher than ours, and so their water runs down to the side of our house. I've graded, I've put built up soil, embankment against the house to kind of roll it back where there's wall, but the window wells just kind of catch it all, and then the window wells fill up with water and leak through.
Well, I'm afraid the cover probably isn't going to fix that, because if it's running across on the ground and putting a cover over the top of it, the window well should be a little bit higher than what the grade level is.
I was thinking about making a box. No, it's about level. It's, maybe an inch above the ground, but not that much higher. I was thinking about boxing it in, creating a structure that's got sides, and then it would have to be at a slant because there is elevation. The window it's above
right.
Ground level, the window.
Okay, covering it is going to be a personal preference because if the window well itself is high enough to deflect the water from the neighbor, then the cover is not necessary. The cover would just be an aesthetics or something to help keep the window clean.
No, it's not high enough.
Well, then you may need to raise the window well a little bit. Is it masonry or a metal or?
It's masonry.
Yeah, so you may need to put another layer of stone or brick or something around it and raise the window well just a little bit higher.
Very clever.
That will do much more than what a cover would do.
I wouldn't have thought that. Thank you.
All right, very good. And we'll go on to another caller here, the next in line. Somebody in Kankakee on our line, too. Hello.
Hi, actually, I'm just driving through. I'm on 57.
Okay, well, go ahead with your question.
Got a question. I want to do some renovations inside my house that would involve the moving some walls, et cetera. I want to get an engineering study as my first step to make sure that I don't rip out the wrong walls, et cetera. But most people that I just contacting in the phone book seem to be more concerned with doing inspections and things for house selling or house buying, and they don't seem to want to take the time to do somebody that just has my questions. What should I look for? How should I find an engineering company that would do this kind of study for me and make these suggestions?
All right. To find to find out the actual structural locations in the house, most licensed architects or structural engineers, you might check with some architects in the area. They can probably do just about as well as an engineer as far as figuring out where your load-bearing beams and where your walls are that can and cannot be moved. A lot of times you'll find contractors that are willing to do that as well. Usually it's not rocket science unless you've got a really, truly unique home. It's pretty easy to find where the load-bearing walls are, and usually there's a center load-bearing wall, and then you've got your end walls, and you have to look and see where your trusses and your rafters are set or resting on.
Right. Most of the people that I'm just looking in the phone book, right, and they're first, usually the person, the receptionist, whoever's first question is, and when is your closing date? And I go, well, we're not selling. And then they say, oh, we're very busy. So that's why I was asking if there was some way I could tell one from the other. That's all.
Unfortunately.
The architect thing sounds, asking an architect sounds like a good idea. I hadn't thought about that. And probably that would be a good idea because I probably shouldn't be designing things myself anyway.
Okay, yeah, if you're looking for load-bearing walls, then a licensed architect is a good way to make sure that you get everything correctly supported.
Okay, when you're in Central Illinois, there's no better talk show in the morning than David Inge and Focus 580.
Well, thank you very much. That's very kind.
All right.
For people who are listening here, you have questions about home maintenance. Now's the day to call. Scott Spies is here from the Spies Home Inspection Service. We do this program every month. It's always on a Monday. So if you got some kind of problem, give us a call, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, the lines are free now, so we have some folks who have questions, they can call. But before we got started, you thought, well, maybe it might be a good idea to talk a little bit about moisture issues in the house, particularly if people are noticing condensation, and this might be the time that they would see
this time
inside
the
house.
This time of year when we get into the fall weather and things start cooling off, and then we have a couple days like this where we get long-term rains, the humidity level outside raises quite a bit. And it's cold enough, the glass will start condensing moisture in the house. The humidity from outdoors, of course, comes through the house, and you end up with some condensation in the windows. I just wanted to point out that if you see a little bit of condensation that you can actually touch or feel, that usually is an indication that the humidity level in the house is high or that you forgot to close your storm window. Usually if you've got a double pane glass or a storm window on the outside of your prime window, you should not get condensation on your windows. The windows are going to be one of the first places to start condensing moisture because they are going to be one of the areas that have the least amount of insulation. Now, if you get some condensation on the storm window, in other words, on the other side of the prime window, you can't feel it through the main window. You have to open it up. That usually means that the storm window is sealing tighter than your prime window, and it's time to either make sure your window is closed all the way or make sure that it's weather stripped. So it's one of those things that just happens this time of year when we have these really humid days. And, of course, the next thing you know, it's going to turn around and drop to very cold temperatures, and the humidity level in the house is going to be high. So it's also common for some type of moisture to be occurring on the windows for a few days while we're doing this weather transition. Now, as soon as it's been cold for a while, the windows should dry right up. If they don't, then it's time to start looking either for a moisture problem or maybe figure out why we're having the cold spot.
So you actually do want some air exchange between the outside and the space in the window between the inside window and the outside window.
For most applications, that's correct. Particularly where the storm window is on the exterior, you want the prime window to seal tighter than the storm window. The storm window is not designed to be airtight. It does not need to be caulked. Matter of fact, I recommend not caulking the bottom of the storm window. It has to have just a little bit of airflow move through there. The insulating quality of the storm window is by how much air it can kind of hold in place, not necessarily, you know, we don't want moving air. Air itself is a very good insulator. Most of the time, insulation is just intended and designed to hold air in place. Now, if we get a natural convection past it or get some moving air, then it doesn't insulate as well. So the storm window, if it's sealed on three sides, so we've got an opening at the bottom to let water drain out, it's usually doing its job. Unfortunately, if it gets sealed on the four side, you can end up with water coming in when the rain comes through the screen, or we can end up with this condensation issue. So mm-hmm. Storm window should be tight but not completely sealed.
Okay. We have a number of callers here, so we'll get back to the phones, starting with somebody in Downs, line 4. Hello.
Yes. Good morning. Mm-hmm. We are in the process of replacing our furnace. It's a very old furnace, 40-plus years old. So I have a couple of questions. What would a good load calculation involve?
Well, if you're going to do some load calculations, there are some very specific formulas for that. Basically, you're wanting to take into account how much the house has changed since the last time you've put in a heating and cooling system in 40 years. So we hopefully have added more insulation in the ceiling, checked for insulation in the walls, maybe possibly put in some better windows and such. They need to do calculations on how much glass area and what direction it faces. A south-facing window will pick up heat, whereas a north-facing window will tend to lose heat. And you don't really want to size it to where it's too large or too small. So trying to get the right size furnace is a good idea. Like I say, if you're going to put in the new furnace, if you've got any areas that could use a little bit of insulation, I'd recommend doing that now so when they size the furnace, it is properly done for the amount of insulation you've got. Most of the furnace heating and cooling type of guys do have formulas that they work off of and can take some quick measurements and give you a good idea of how many BTUs it's going to take to heat that particular area.
We're soliciting several quotes. I thought maybe I could differentiate between installers on the basis of the quality of their load calculation.
Well, I don't have the calculations right here off the top of my head.
Yeah, but the considerations involved, yes.
Yeah, the considerations involved are, you know, how much north-facing glass do I have? How much insulation do I have? How much shade do I have? Because not only are we sizing the furnace, but most of the time if you're replacing it, you're sizing an air conditioner as well. Particularly on something of that age. So there are several different factors, and there are some formulas that are available. I usually just hit the old Google button and come up with one or two that I can start working with to do some rough calculations on how many exterior square feet of glass, exterior wall space facing north versus facing south, et cetera.
Right. Well, one additional question, if I may. There are options for a two-speed fan versus a variable-speed fan. What would be your recommendation?
Most fans do have more than two speeds. The variable speed is probably more commonly found on the higher efficiency systems. They work well in that at different temperature changes. If it's not as cold outside, we don't need to be blowing hot air. We can actually start blowing a little bit of warm air. Most fans that I've come across have about five fan settings, but only two of them are wired up. Some of the newer furnaces do actually vary the fan speed versus the temperature in the heat exchanger. That's going to be pretty much the manufacturer of the furnace is going to determine whether or not that you use a variable or a two-speed for their particular furnace application. And I usually will find that the variable are on the very high end or what we'll call the high efficiency furnaces in the 90% range?
Well, we're intending to get a furnace that qualifies for the $1,500 tax credit.
Mm-hmm.
So it will be presumably a high efficiency.
Mm-hmm. And then probably in order to make it work properly and get the a good efficient airflow, it will most likely have the variable speed fan.
Okay. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Very good. Thank you. Well, we'll come back here to Champagne in line one. Hello.
Hi. We have a garage that sits lower than our neighbor's garage, and they don't have gutters, although I'm not sure where they would run the water off to anyway. But we have a hard time keeping water out of our garage and wonder who a person consults with about this drainage, water runoff issues.
Well, if you're not going to ask a home inspector, then I would probably go to a landscaper. Generally speaking, water coming into a garage is surface drainage. And so somebody that's familiar with some landscaping and can take a look at it and find where the low spots are in the property or front or back of the property and figure out how to drain things to there. Worst case scenario, we may have to put in a tiling system where we can catch the water and then drain it out below grade if there's a high spot or an obstruction that prevents it from getting out and away. So, yeah, either home inspector or a landscaper would be my recommendation.
Thank you.
All right. And to Bloomington, Illinois, line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
Yes, I have a question. I have a bay window, and the roof line comes out, over that bay window. and the gutter goes along that side, but the water still shoots out over that kick out and drops straight down and gets water in the basement. And now the basement, concrete, it's a concrete block wall basement, but on one side there's a crack along it. So I would like to know, is there some way to, what should I do on the roof for that water kicking out, if there's anything I can do? And also, do I just need to get that concrete wall, like, patched, or do I need to put up another wall because it's a structural support on the outside edge of the wall?
Okay. Well, obviously, without seeing a crack, it's kind of hard to say whether or not a crack is structural in a block wall. Generally, block walls are hollow core. So there are hollow spaces in there, and a little bit of movement can cause some cracking, and most of the cracking I see is not what I'll call significant enough to be concerned about, particularly at corners and such. If it continues to move, then, of course, there is always something we got to figure out why and where and what's causing it. But if it's a crack that looks like it's been there for a while, probably we just had a little bit of settlement, a little bit of a soil movement. If you get water next to the foundation wall, it's going to soak through the outside of the block. If the block is 8 inches wide and it's got a 1 inch on the outside before we get to the hollow core and 1 inch on the inside before we get to the hollow core, that water just soaks through that little 1 inch of concrete and starts filling up or running down inside the blocks. Yes, a crack is where you're going to see it come out, but if you seal the crack, then all it's going to do is fill the block and eventually find some place to seep out through. So our better plan of action is to prevent the water from getting next to the foundation wall. Since you've got an area that's hard to collect water, in other words, the bay window, bow windows are notorious for having multiple facets to where you can't get a good angle on a gutter.
Uh-huh.
What I would do is a grading below or the soil below. Okay. Get a slope on it to where it slopes away from the house for about the first 3 feet, and then throw down a sheet of plastic, not a landscaping fabric, but a black plastic, and then put a layer of gravel or mulch or something on that line. Now what you've got is this layer of plastic that will catch any water dripping off the window. They'll roll it out at least 2 to 3 feet away from the house before it can start soaking down into the ground. That way it's out and away from your block wall.
Okay.
What we're going to do is put a water barrier or water shield on the soil so that the water can't soak down until it slopes outward away from the house.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Another solution on something like that, David, just for our other listeners, is they do have a what we call a drained gravel bed, and that is on houses where we have no overhang or houses where we have no way of putting on a gutter. We can put a perforated tile underground in a trench, line the trench with plastic, put the tile on top of it, and then fill it with gravel, and then any water running off a roof goes through the gravel and finds this perforated drainage tile, and then you direct the drainage tile out and away. So, yeah, some type of vapor barrier on the soil so the water doesn't go through. And in cases where it doesn't drain away well, then a drainage tile can be used as drain gravel bed.
Yeah. And if you're going to do that with putting the plastic down, what do you have to think about to make sure that you got plastic that's not just going to deteriorate and after a year it's just going to fall apart?
Well, that's a very good point. Basically, anything that's got a clear plastic is not going to have any UV protection, so you need a black plastic. And a thicker plastic, of course, is going to be more durable. I would say probably in the 6 to 8 mil thick range, just something that is going to put up with a little bit of abuse because the mailman's going to walk around or the dog's going to be digging around, so you want something that's fairly thick. I would say about 6 to 8 mil.
All right. Our guest here this morning in this hour of Focus 580 is Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. It's our monthly program on home maintenance. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And next, we will talk with someone in Champaign and line 3. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Hi, I'm taking the siding, drywall, and insulation out of 100-plus year old house because there's been water from leaky windows over the years. And what I'm doing on the outside of the house is putting that foiled back foam board and then wrapping it with Tyvek. And on the inside of the house, and then siding it and replacing the windows. And then on the inside of the house, I was wondering, since I'm doing one wall at a time, I'm not doing, it's going to take me a year or possibly two to finish all the walls. I've gotten two of them done.
Mm-hmm.
because there's still going to be some leakage of water in those, you know, in the cavity in between the boards, do I want to put on the inside foam board insulation or the batting kind of insulation, which is what it had, and the batting soaked up all the moisture that got in before. So I thought, well, if I'm not doing it all at once, would it be best to have an air cavity in there and the foam board, which doesn't have a very high R rating, but, you know, until it's all finished, should I just go two sides of the foam board instead of foam board and on the inside insulation, batting insulation?
Well, first of all, I'm going to have to recommend that whatever you're doing first is to get everything watertight from the exterior. You don't want water in the wall whether or not you have foam insulation or whether or not you have fiberglass insulation. So the exterior really needs to be your first priority, getting the house wrap around it. Even if the siding doesn't end up on it immediately, at least get the house wrap on it to make it watertight. Because any type of insulation you put in the wall, if you get some moisture, we have problems with either mold or mildew or rotting. The foam does not absorb the moisture, but it does not allow airflow through, so the moisture doesn't go anywhere. So any place where the foam is sitting against the wood stud or against any wood sheathing will end up with a rotting effect. Key thing here, first of all, is get it watertight first and then worry about the interior. So once the exterior is watertight, then you can start doing your insulating and your sealing.
Okay. I'll leave the inside undone until I get the outside finished.
Getting the outside watertight before you start putting stuff on the inside would be the recommendation, so we don't seal any water inside that wall.
Uh-huh.
As far as what type of insulation in the walls, there's so many different types, it's mind-boggling. The common ones we find around here are the fiberglass bats. One of the good ones preventing airflow and such is you spray in urethane foam or one of the biofoams, where they basically use some type of soybean oil mix to make an expanded foam that they spray on things and seals everything up airtight.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime you use a foam insulation inside the house, you have to put a fire-rated covering over it, basically a fire-type drywall.
Yeah.
So that basically the foam, if we were to have a fire, the foam could emit toxic fumes, which would overcome you before even the flames. So any foam insulation in the house is supposed to be covered with something such as a Type X drywall, so that it does have a little bit of a 20 to 30 minute fire protection, so that you are not overcome by fumes from the burning insulation.
All right. Well, thank you.
Another thing you could do is a blown in cellulose or a blown in or loose fill fiberglass. And that can be done after the wall coverings are put on. Although, in my opinion, the easiest and usually the most cost-effective would be the fiberglass bats that you put on from the inside before you put up your drywall.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And when putting all your Tyvek and everything around the exterior of the house, make sure you get proper flashings around the windows.
Yeah.
Basically, most of the construction we find in the Champaign area, we've got guys using the Tyvek tape to seal the Tyvek house wrap to the windows, and that is not what that tape is designed for. Tyvek does make a special flashing tape, as well as several other manufacturers. Pella's got their own, which is basically a bituminous tape or a tar type tape about 3 or 4 inches wide.
That's what I've been using.
Okay.
Wonderful.
For around the windows and doors, and there are some very specific flashing methods which will help seal it out, where you start at the bottom, you put a piece of tape down, you put the window in, then you tape the sides, and then you lift your house wrap, put a piece of tape across the top, and then put the house wrap down over the top of it. And diagrams like that are available as well on the internet, or actually I have some that I've drawn up if people are interested.
Well, so far so good. Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, very good. Back again to somebody in Urbana. This is line number one. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, mm-hmm. I got another question about heating.
Okay.
I'm in a two-story house. I have a bedroom that's above a front porch, and the insulation between the porch and the bedroom, of course, isn't very good, so it gets rather chilly in the winter. I've been messing with the dampers a bit on the heating pipes and whatnot in the basement, but I was in one of the home stores a while ago, and I noticed those fans that you can stick in the heating pipes, whatever they're called, the pipes, that then turn on automatically when the heater goes on. Do those actually work? Do they kick out enough? Do they add enough, push enough hot air up into the room to make it worthwhile, or are they just a waste?
Okay, you're referring to a duct booster fan.
Yeah, those.
Okay, the duct booster fans are... there are times when they are used. Most of the time is during people doing additions and stuff because the original system either was not intended to heat that area or the area has changed and the heat requirements to that area have changed. I would have to consider a duct booster fan to be more of a Band-Aid, but it's oftentimes the only option that you can have. It does help draw more of the air from the furnace to that one particular area. By playing with your dampers that you were indicating where you can damper down certain areas, that will help direct more air one direction or the other. But oftentimes you can close off too many things and then you just don't get enough air through the furnace system to actually have the furnace operating efficiently. You start blocking things up too much and putting too much pressure on the circulation fan and we don't end up with enough air moving past the heat exchanger to cool it correctly. So like I say, there are times when the duct booster fan is probably the only option. If you've got it over the top of a porch, one of the things you might want to consider is putting another layer of insulation on the porch ceiling or the floor of the of that room, and then put a either a foam or something like that, and then putting a finished product over the top of it to give a little bit more insulation.
Mm-hmm.
The booster fan would work. Another solution could be, since I'm assuming that only in really cold weather is that room that much cooler.
It's already cooler in there than it is in the rest of the house, even in the weather we have now. I mean, it's livable as far as I'm concerned, but my kid's another matter.
It sounds like we've got some air leakage or something that's cooling that area down, because if it's sealed up tight, anytime you have a living space over another living space, you end up with hot air coming up and warming the second floor. And so when you've got an area, a bonus room over the top of a porch or over the top of a garage where you don't have a heat source, that room will be cooler because we don't have that heat source from underneath. There are several different ways around it as far as you could put in an auxiliary electric heater in that room to where it's on a separate thermostat so that it stays a little bit warmer or can be controlled separately from the rest of the house.
We've had that the last couple of years, and of course the power bill of those months are rather large.
Depending on how much you use, if it's a regular electric baseboard, yes, it can be. They do make some radiant units that usually operate for a little bit less expensive. If you've got a lot of air leakage, particularly, like, say, with your situation where we've got a porch, you probably have windows on at least two or three sides, and you've got the cold air from underneath. Make sure you got a good insulation over the top. A lot of the times those porch-type rooms they had a little bit of insulation over it, but they're kind of hard to get to, so they may not have enough ceiling insulation, and so you're losing some heat out the top. It's going to be a matter of going around and trying to seal up all your air gaps and get the room more efficient. Yes, adding more heat to it is going to be one thing, but trying to get the room more efficient so we're not losing the heat we're putting into it.
Okie doke. Thank you much.
All right, very good. On again, next caller's in Charleston. Line 4. Hello.
Hi there. I'm calling about carpenter bees. I seem to have been afflicted with them on the east side of my house, and I have wood siding. And the exterminator came around this past week, and he said that he would recommend putting latex paint on the house. Would that take care of that? Or do you have other recommendations?
Okay, what kind of siding are we looking at here?
Wood siding.
Cedar siding or a pine siding or?
I don't know. The house was built in 1917, and I don't know much about
it.
It's painted now, but they've been boring holes through it.
Yes, they will do that. Perfectly round quarter-inch holes.
Yes.
Usually I recommend spraying a little bit of 7 dust in the holes, and that will usually deter them from coming around.
Right. We did that. They were coming in the front eaves, and so I did that, and then they moved to the back this year. And so
Yeah, it's amazing that some houses they like and some houses they don't, or some wood they do like. Basically, doing the pest control, doing the dusting and such is about the only way that I've found to do much with them. As far as the paint, I've never found the paint to be a deterrent for them.
So even if I put on a latex paint, that wouldn't necessarily help.
Well, most of the paints you get nowadays are latex. There are some oil bases out there, but I don't know that the paint is actually going to deter the carpenter bees. No.
Okay, and then how bad is the damage that they do to the structure of the house?
Well, if you catch them early enough, it's not a problem. And most of the time, they're in trim boards. Very rarely are they actually any structural members.
Okay.
Usually they're in a soffit or fascia board or something like that. So I really don't find too much damage to the structure from the carpenter bees. But if they get into a main beam and they do a lot of boring, they can weaken things. They're pretty good engineers. They dig their little tunnels in there that, and a round hole usually doesn't affect the structural durability of the board. So as a general rule, I don't find any collapsing garage headers or anything like that from carpenter bees, but
okay.
They're still kind of a nuisance, and it is a good idea to get to them quickly so that we don't have to be sitting there going, I wonder how deep that goes. It's amazing. I've taken coat hangers and followed them up 15, 18 inches up into a board.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I'll treat them then. Thanks so much for your advice.
Thanks. I have heard supposedly that they won't chew into a painted surface, but it sounds like your experience is, they will.
They won't as much because they're liking the wood, and if they can't feel or see the wood, then they don't necessarily know what's behind there. But I have found holes bored in painted surfaces, so... while it may deter them somewhat, it's not 100% guaranteed.
Okay. Let's go next to West Chicago here, line number two. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. I was curious, I got a comment, and then I got a question for you. One of the comments that gentleman had talked about that you had on earlier about the venting, his ductwork, putting that fan in there. People forget to flip their, baffles around every year from summer to winter to summer. I get the funniest thing because people forget you can change that in your vents and in the rooms, and that tends to help a lot because there's a lot of rooms, like in my house, that I'm not in the winter.
Yeah.
Basically have closed off, and it makes a big difference.
Yeah, that's balancing the heating and cooling system between winter and summer, yes.
Yeah, well, people forget you got to do that with a house. You can't just leave it the same for 100 years or whatever. But my question is, I'm trying to figure out a way to heat my garage without spending a lot of money. But I was looking at some heaters that they had. They're like the kind that you could put up on the wall that are electric when it faced down, like you would see in maybe in a store somewhere where they have them facing. They're up towards the ceiling, but they're facing down.
Yeah, radiant heaters.
Radiant heaters. What do you think of those? Or is there a better solution? I'm trying to think of it a little bit, or maybe I could plug it into an extension cord or something.
Well, first of all, I'd have to say heaters and extension cords don't go well together.
Okay.
It's one more connection that can actually get hot. Radiant heaters are very good. It all depends on what you're trying to heat the garage for. A radiant heater will try and heat the objects and floors and such that are below it without necessarily bringing the room temperature up quite as much. If you're working in the garage on projects and such, a radiant heater will work quite well. If you're in the garage converting it to a sleeping area or something like that, no, they're not going to work very well at all. So I'm assuming that you've got some type of hobby that's keeping you out in the garage on a regular basis.
Right. Well, I do some varnishing. I make wood furniture, and I'm trying to do it where, the summertime's been great around here. It's been temperate, but my garage has the seals, no matter how much what I do to the garage door seals, the wind blows so much because I face west that it blows the doors up against the rails. And there's just a tiny opening, but it's enough to get, cold weather in there. So the wind blowing, I'm trying to cut down on that. Of course, varnish, you have to be up a certain temperature. So I'm thinking if I put something on a timer.
The radiant heaters will help well because radiant heaters will help heat not only you but also the objects in the room. So, yes, I think the radiant system would be good for that. Obviously, we want to stay away from any flame surface, any flame-type heaters for that type of woodworking, because we don't want the fumes from the varnish to build up and catch fire.
Right, so you want, going electric.
Yeah. Radiant system would work well. I think you'll find that it'll be very comfortable because while you're out there working, it can be on. It will tend to warm up your wood surfaces. It'll tend to warm up yourself and things like that without having to spend a lot of time trying to warm all the air in the garage as well.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We got about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's here on the program once a month. It's always a Monday. We talk about home maintenance. So questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Just for a second to talk some more about balancing your system, your heating and cooling, depending on what time of the year it is. And maybe there are some people who don't know this. We've certainly talked about this before. Maybe people, you know, they know, well, in the room, there's a damper there. You can open it or you can close it, or you can close it down part of the way so you can regulate how much air comes into the room. But that's not the only way to control how much air comes into the room. There's something like that, there should be, in the ducts to also control how much air goes into the room. And if there's some room that place that you don't want, you know, you say, I don't need the warm air, you don't just close down the place where the air comes out. You got to go find out where, track that duct back, find out where it is. And if there's a damper in there, close it off.
Quite often, the heating systems are designed with the balancing dampers. Usually, there's one or two near the top of the furnace plenum, or depending on the bottom if you've got a downflow system, that can actually help direct the airflow from the main trunk line to different ends of the house. Because we do find that in the summertime, we need to have more air going to southern exposures, upper levels. In the wintertime, we need to have more heat going to lower levels, northern exposures. So there is some balancing dampers in most systems. Now, not all ductwork has a damper. Usually they're identifiable by a metal rod on the side of the duct that you can either turn to where it's parallel with the duct or perpendicular to the duct to open and close it. And that is to help in addition to closing the individual ducts, the vanes that you see on the registers. Some balancing is a good idea just to make the house more comfortable. I usually recommend that you get about 4 or 5 inexpensive thermometers. Put them in one place so you can see that they all read the same. If they don't, make a mark on them as to which one's high or low. And then distribute them through the house. And in the heating season, you find the room that is the coolest and you make sure everything is open to that room. And then you take the warmest room and start dampering it down until the other rooms start warming up to match it. And once you get it closer, you know, within a couple degrees, then when you walk from room to room, you don't go, oh, this room's cold or this room's warm. It tends to keep the house more comfortable. And the situation that we had on our earlier caller where he had a room that was over an unheated area, such as a porch area, then we have to worry about additional insulation because we do have more surface area losing heat. And so, yes, if we can get more heat to that area, it'll help. Oftentimes, that type of room, they'll put the ductwork near the inside wall instead of all the way to the outside wall, and that gives you a perceived comfort problem. Basically, you can get the room temperature up to the rest of the house, but you feel cold in the room anyway because it's got 3 or 4 cold surfaces, floor being cold because we don't have anything from underneath and the outside walls, and your body will radiate heat towards cool surfaces. So you can walk into a room that is the same temperature as the rest of the rooms, but it just feels colder if the walls are cold and your body heat radiates towards those cold surfaces. So in situations like that, we need to get the heat out towards the outside walls, or we need to add a little bit more insulation in the walls so we don't have that cold surface for you to radiate heat towards. So it's balancing and just doing a general tune-up on the heating system, make sure it's got a good air filter in it so that we're moving enough air past it. Things like that will help even it out so that the house is more comfortable for the heating season.
Okay. I have some other calls here. We'll try to get them all. Somebody who is clearly on the road here on I-74. We'll go there. Line 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi.
Yeah.
Hi. My question is about inspections for new construction.
how much you know, how much if it is recommended, or at least because they have the first for homeowners who are buying a new construction, they have this 1 year warranty for most systems in the home. But even then, would you recommend like a thorough inspection for a new construction?
I do like to recommend inspection during new construction because there are certain things that an inspector may find that the contractor does not see. Most contractors usually use subcontractors to do quite a bit of the work, and it's not possible for them to be on site at all times to keep an eye on them.
Right.
And there are things that the home inspectors, since we're not building 365 days a year, we have time to go to seminars and learn more about some of the new building materials. So sometimes there are differences in how building materials should be applied that the builder, mm-hmm. hopefully he knows what he's doing, but occasionally the technology catches up to him before he knows what's going on. So I like to recommend some type of inspection, yes.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, and line two is next. Someone in Champaign. Hello. Line two?
Line two is next.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh,
we're getting a strange kind of echo there. I'm not sure what that was all about, but we got you now. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I have a question about these new furnaces,
mm-hmm.
the ones that the exhaust is cool and you just use the pipe out the side of the house. Well, a friend of mine had found that his furnace wasn't quite turning on the way it should be, so he looked into the exhaust, and here were some dead wasps kind of built up in there, and I guess that causes some back pressure or something to make the furnace not quite work properly. So my question is, when you have those installed, should there be screens put over the intake and the exhaust part of those pipes?
Oftentimes we end up with a screen on the intake side. The exhaust side usually isn't as critical because very rarely will we get things crawling in there. The fumes from the furnace are enough to ward off most intrusions. You know, when you get the hot flue gases going through there with a little carbon monoxide and a little carbon dioxide and things like that, usually we don't have too much problem. But yes, they do have screens usually for the intake side to help keep out rodents and such. Ideally, they're placed away from the house far enough, you know, get out 5 or 6 inches to where things can't get to them easily.
Right.
But I've seen everything from birds trying to nest in them to the wasp type situation. And yes, they should be checked once in a while. And if you get a back pressure on the system, then the furnace will not fire.
So, if we decide to put a piece of screen over there, is there any, you know, the size of the screen holes, or is there any problem with the air pressure building up because there's a screen across the opening?
Well, you don't want to use a screen like a window screen. You want to use something more what we'll call a hardware cloth, which is a quarter inch or an eighth inch opening, something that will let the air flow through there. Amazingly enough, of all the 90% or the condensing style furnaces I've seen, very, very few of them have had any blockages. So it's something that could be a problem, but and generally speaking, it's not a problem.
Yeah. Well, in this case, it was because there's a wasp and then there was another wasp and they just kept coming in. So I think they liked that particular pipe and yeah, we'll deal with it. Thank you.
All right, thank you. So it just sounds like, as if that's it, at least when you're getting ready to go into the heating season. You should check it just to make sure.
It's one of those things. You walk by it every time you cut the grass or walk around the yard. You can see this little pipe sticking out through the house. And, yes, it's a good idea to have some type of screening over the top, particularly the intake. Like I say, I do, you know, 300 or 400 houses a year, and I just don't find that many of them that are blocked. So it's while it's not a bad idea for most instances, it's usually not a problem.
Okay. Another Champagne caller, line three. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
How are you?
Good.
I had a question regarding, we recently had a new furnace installed and by one local company. And 2 years ago, we had had a new water heater installed. And when they came out to inspect the furnace, the city inspector came out. He noted there was no inspection sticker on the water heater, plus there were some other things that weren't done right. And now I'm trying to figure out what's the best way to approach the previous company in terms of what should be changed on the water heater. Just call them and say, you know, we didn't realize at the time. It had to do with there's no hand shutoff valve. There's a copper pipe to the overflow release that was never connected to the water heater. There's no gas line trap and no inspection sticker. So should I just not worry about these things, or what would be the best way to approach?
Well, if you had somebody install it, then I would.
We did, yeah.
Yeah, I would probably contact them and say, hey, it was brought to my attention by a city inspector that these things were not done.
Okay.
And get their take on it, their idea of what needs to be done. I do like to see a copper pipe on the pressure relief valve, something that if the pressure relief valve were ever go off, it does spray down away from you so you can
right.
get to the gas valve to shut it off.
Okay.
Usually the pipe that goes in there is – it doesn't have to be put in tightly. We're looking at probably $10 in materials at the top, so it's not a big issue one way or the other.
I think it was there but leaning in the corner somewhere.
Okay. A drip leg on the gas line is something that I do recommend. I find an awful lot of them that are installed without one, and I usually note that they probably were not installed by somebody that got a permit or somebody that probably was not a plumber. Yes, they are a good idea.
What
they
was
take
that
a
called
little,
again?
The drip leg for the
leg.
Gas line.
Okay.
And a shutoff valve. Well, I can't say that would be a... so important that we'd have to cut the water line and put one in. When I was putting one in, I would make sure that it was there just for more for convenience than anything
right.
else.
Okay, so it's not a safety issue, not being able to turn that off without
yeah,
a
yeah. I think the local codes do require one, but it's more of a convenience so that we can drain that.
Okay. All right, well.
But, yeah, I would just call them up and say, well, these items were brought to my attention and see what their take on it is and if they're – if they're willing to work with you, that'd be great. If not, you may have to take further steps.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks so much.
All right.
Well, thank you.
Well, there, pretty much. We're going to have to finish it up for this time around. Any last sort of thing you'd like to lead with folks?
No, just make sure that you've checked, made sure all your storm windows are closed by this time of year because our cold weather is coming in.
All right. Scott Spies is a home inspector with the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's here once a month, always on a Monday to the show. Thanks.
Thank you.
Much.